Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Kelvin of Rudd. Narrated by Dylan Lynch. Performed by David Coyne, Tracy Lynn Oliveira, Kimberly Gilbert, Lily David, Michael John Casey, David Harris, Joel David Santner, Michael Glenn, Thomas Penny, Stephen Carpenter, Elizabeth Jernigan, Alyssa Wilmoth, Nanette Savard, Ken Jackson, Eric Messner, Thomas Keegan, Terrence Aselford, Patrick Bussing, Drew Copus, Nick DePinto, Christopher Graybill, Bradley Smith, Gary Tells, Kelvin of Rudd, Book 2, Serpent's Silver.
Helm Knight Hackleberry lay back against the pillows. Her brown eyes were closed and her bosom heaved shallowly. Her shiny black hair framed her lovely oval face. She was as beautiful as she had been on their wedding day 7 months ago, Kelvin thought. He lay beside her, squeezing her calloused yet very feminine hand. They were on their new bed in their new home, but they were not alone, and this was no pleasant interlude. He glanced up at his sister John, who was unusually silent. Then his gaze passed to John's normally smiling husband, Lester, who was quite serious now. He wished again that he hadn't let them talk him into this. Helen's hand was growing cold now, as if she were dying. Oh, it was so like death, this astral traveling, death from poisoning. His hand tightened on hers, but she did not stir. He started receiving her thoughts.
I'm back at the underground river now.
Kelvin became aware of her sensations, the cold cave walls drifting by, the passages twisting, splitting, merging.
The floor! The floor! I see it now!
He was speaking for her, but he saw it too. The water falling, falling into a darkness filled with stars. He willed her away from that dread void.
The other room! The other room!
Then she was taking him, through her awareness and his, through the round, solid door. They floated into the metallic chamber that only round ears such as the two of them could enter without causing its destruction. They hovered together above an open book on a table and a box the size of a closet. The walls of the box were lined with dials and what appeared to be clocks.
He left here, into the other frame. He stepped in here to follow the path of your father. It will still work for us. We can cross the astral bridge through Muvar's magic to where Kyan and your father are.
For Kyan was Kelvin's half-brother. They had been on opposite sides and had fought. Though they were friends now, Kyan's guilt had led him to go on the risky tour through the dreaded flaw, searching for his lost parents. He had not returned. Helen and Kelvin entered the box. The vision became a blackness so deep it shimmered. Stars appeared, shining all around and through and into them. Existence whirled, collapsed, and expanded. Time and place ceased to have meaning. Then they were moved into a hazy chamber closet like the one they had entered. The closet wall with its clocks reappeared, forming out of the confusion. The image needed tuning. It seemed to be far away. But even as Kelvin thought of that, the sights and sounds and smells of the new location came into clear focus. They had arrived. Where? Two sets of footprints crossed from the closet to a rock wall, where a large round metal door stood ajar. It might have been the same door they had just entered, but that one was closed. The footprints might have been their own, but they were going in the opposite direction. And in any event, Kelvin and Helen were not here physically, so these could be John Knight's and Kyan's prints. They began moving, bodiless, but with direction. They paused, Helm sensing the way. There was a metal rope ladder anchored to a solid ring in the cliffside. The ladder descended into a large tree that seemed similar to the beanut tree where Kelvin had found his magic gauntlet. They swooped down to the roots of the tree and along the ground. As Helm followed the pull of the brother Kelvin had first met on a battlefield and tried to kill 9 months before, he looked around to the extent his form allowed. He saw or sensed a display in a tall oapple tree. Three silver spirals hung from a branch and produced the sound when the breeze twirled them. They looked like snakeskins, silver serpent hides that were stiff and dry, yet also shiny and bright. Now they were traveling across a wide valley, mountains, and rolling farmland similar to that of Rudd. On and on, interminably, but then swooping abruptly, hawk fashion, to a palace on a river bluff. They entered the palace and drifted through spectacular halls filled with art objects, some of which seemed familiar. On down carpeted hallways, polished corridors, and banistered stairs to a dank, dark, foul-smelling place that seemed made for fear.
But what is it, Kel?
Dungeon?
Indeed it was. Exactly such a dungeon as Kyan's mother, the evil Queen Zoanna, had used to confine Kelvin and his father, and Rufert, the good King of Rudd. Now he could see in the dim light that came through the high barred windows. There was his father, John Knight, haggard and dirty. There was his brother Kyan, in no better shape. And a third man, battered, blood-spattered, lying on the floor, propping his head with his arm, evidently too weak from loss of blood to do more. Standing between them and a barred door was a wide man wearing a silver crown. Kelvin focused on the man's face.
Rufert!
But no. This Rufert had round ears, as did the prisoners, while their Rudd counterparts had ears as pointed as John's and Lester's. The Rudd King's face, even after years of imprisonment, had a jovial appearance around the jowls that nothing could quite erase. This nearly identical face was taut and grim by comparison.
It's Rufert!
At the King's gesture, a man in uniform unlocked the cell, entered, and bent over the wounded man. John Knight grabbed the bars, seeming about to speak. Undeterred, the torturer pushed the unfortunate man's head down on the floor and twisted it sideways. Then he brought out a silver tube, held it above the prisoner's ear, unstoppered it, and tilted it carefully. Something silvery oozed out and flowed, undulating, into the man's ear. The guard paused only long enough to make sure the vial was empty. Then he let go of the prisoner and stepped quickly away. The prisoner pulled his face from the grime of the floor. His hand came up to touch his ear as if it itched. Then his look of perplexity darkened into something else. He clawed at his ear as if trying to wrench it out of his head. The King made a ghastly smile.
Silver's not so nice now, is it, Smith? Now that the little beast is chewing in you.
The man shook all over from head to foot, his arms and legs spasmed.
We must go back! We are going back!
With that, the dungeon faded and slipped sideways. They were pulled as though by elastic back to the chamber, into the closet, through darkness and stars. It happened so swiftly as to be instant. Their minds seemed to shatter. Then they were home. They were on their bed in their room with their closest friends looking down at them.
Oh, Kelvin, we must help them. We must.
But I have things to do here. There's the prophecy.
And you will fulfill it, dear. You will. But you are a hero and a round ear. Only a round ear can journey to the chamber as Kyan did. Only a round ear can make the trip we just did.
You can't go!
Oh, Kelvin, you're so brave. I knew you'd want to go to that other world and rescue your father and brother. I knew you just couldn't do anything else.
Don't worry. We'll take good care of her.
Kelvin knew that Lester and his sister would do that. He had no decent excuse to get out of another mission of foolish, attempted heroism. He wished that he had never agreed to let Helm take that astral trip. Yet that prisoner, with the appalling silver beastie in his ear, was that the fate awaiting John Knight and Kyan if someone didn't get them out of the dungeon? Kelvin was sickly certain that it was, and that he was the only one who could do anything about it. He was a coward, but he had to act. Kyan reached the bottom rung of the metallic rope ladder and looked down. From the chamber entrance, the ladder had appeared to disappear into the very top of a very large beanut tree. It still did. The rope was of a material different from any he had seen before, and it seemed to grow out of the trunk where the spreading branches formed the crown. This was a different world, but perhaps not too different. He clambered easily down the close-set branches of the beanut tree. The vegetation of this frame seemed exactly like that of his own. The armored gloves made climbing easier, but he could hardly say how. Well, yes, he could. He found that he could easily hang on to a branch by just a couple of fingertips, feeling no strain. He let go of a branch and dropped the remaining distance to the base of the tree. He looked up, but he could not see the ladder or the cliff face with its open metal door. The secret was well hidden. Recently, Kyan had read the parchment book he had found in the chamber before taking the gauntlets and the alien weapon and launching his own adventure. Each overlapping world, he had learned, was almost like the ones touching it, but with small, subtle differences. He had never figured out quite how his father had crossed over. It seemed to have involved war magic of a sort not understood in Rudd. But John Knight was unique, and therefore, so were his sons. He paused, trying to locate the source of the sound. It seemed to come from a large oapple. He walked that way, staring hard into the branches where three long silver belts or spirals hung and twisted in the river breeze. They were silver too, real silver, in a pattern like that of overlapping scales. He removed a gauntlet, fitted a thumbnail under a scale, and tried to pull the scale loose. It remained fast. The organic and inorganic were seemingly one. He tested the scale of one of the skins with the point of his knife. It came away silver. Silver like that had to be very pure. He resumed his journey along the road. At home, this path would have taken him through the mountainous region near Franklin, not far from the dragon country. He smiled. Soon he would have to swallow one of the dragon berries in his pack and see if they worked. The road forked. Impulsively, he followed the side branch into the mountains. He felt more comfortable this way, though he could not have said why. After all, at home, it would have taken him into the domain of the dangerous wild things. He noticed in another oapple tree hung another of the spiral chimes, parchment thin, yet curled into stiffness. A chill ran up and down his back. He had a feeling that something was wrong. Through the mists far below in the valley, among rocks that had rolled down over the centuries, he could see a movement. People, maybe a crowd. From this distance they seemed short and broad, reminding him of Quito, his grandfather's dwarf apprentice. In the midst of the crowd, a little to the front, and grasped by either hand, was a taller, slimmer person. It was hard for Kyan to see, but this could be a woman or a girl of normal stature. He strained his eyes, wishing that he could make things out better. The dwarves gathered with the prisoner, for so she seemed, at a spot between two upright rocks the size of horses. Two of the dwarves did something that produced a flash of silver. Then all the small people withdrew, leaving the woman or girl apparently shackled between the two stones. Half running, wishing he had a horse, he descended the slope in as fast a fashion as he could manage. He did not know how long the woman would be there, or what sort of danger he might face. He just had to know, lest he forever regret it. When he broke through the bushes and faced her at close range, he was startled by her beauty. Her slim arms were stretched on either side, tethered by chains of silver. She had long blonde hair and deep blue eyes, and a figure that...
Leave! Oh, leave before it comes, before it slithers out and devours us, please!
You need help!
No, no, it will come soon, the appointed one, the one that always comes.
You're intended as a sacrifice?
She tossed her head, her hair flipping from her left ear and exposing it for the first time.
It's coming! I hear it!
I'm not afraid of it, whatever it is.
Kain fixed his eyes on the dread aperture and waited, knowing that whatever appeared was not going to run or tease. A large silvery snout thrust from the hole, just in time to catch a ray of sunshine that lighted the cliff's face. Then, a silvery head emerged, followed by a long, long, undulating silver body. It was a serpent as large around as a warhorse, a serpent covered all over with silver scales. The serpent emerged sinuously, all the way from the hole, lifting its head and reared back. Then that dread mouth opened, revealing dagger-length crystalline fangs. Drops of clear liquid fell to the ground. The beady black eyes looked into his. They held him as the body writhed behind the head, getting into better position for attack. Kain found himself staring into bottomless pits. The snout darted suddenly, along with the long, flat, enormous head. The gauntlets, unaffected by the serpent's spell, raised his unresisting arms and his sword hand for him. The left gauntlet grasped the lower jaw of the serpent. The right gauntlet swung the sword hard at the serpent's eye. The blade rebounded from the silver scales, leaving a barely detectable groove. His arm felt the jolt, and pain lanced through his shoulder. The serpent's head went back. It was not hurt, but now it seemed more cautious. Perhaps it distrusted anything that resisted the power of its mesmeric gaze. Suddenly, his left hand within the gauntlet began suddenly and severely to hurt. It was as if he had thrust his armored hand into a fire. The left gauntlet dropped from his hand and landed on the grass. The monster bared his fangs again and prepared for a final strike.
Back! Back into your hole, you worm!
Help of some sort had arrived, but was it soon enough or strong enough? Could it break the spell that held him and give him even a slight chance to survive? Helen gave Kelvin a startled look, then put down the dough for the exotic dish she was making, an appleberry pie whose recipe had been in both their families.
Who?
Kelvin shrugged. He was putting things together in a travel sack for the journey he didn't want to make. Yet it was expected of him, and he did feel obliged to rescue his father and half-brother. It wasn't as though he wouldn't have the laser and the gauntlets that had saved his life numerous times.
I expect John to come over. She and Lester won't let me start out alone, or with just you and my horse.
Helen went to the door and heaved at the heavy latch.
Helen Hackleberry?
The stranger at the door was a formidable sight. He was a big, raw-boned man with a stuckle cap pulled down around his ears despite the heat of the summer day. He was approximately Hal Hackleberry's age, with a big, ugly nose and black beard, dirty clothing, and a travel sack on his back. He wore a formidable sword.
Yes, I'm Helen Hackleberry. Mrs. Hackleberry.
You won't recognize me. You never laid eyes on me before. Adult eyes, that is.
Helen frowned. Kelvin held his position. This didn't sound like robbery, but... Abruptly, the man reached up and pulled off his stuccle cap. His ears popped into view. They were large and red and round, as unpointed as her own and Kelvin's.
I'm Sean Riley, nicknamed St. Helens.
St. Helens? You...
Right, girl. I'm your father.
His dark eyes swept past her to Kelvin.
And you be the round ear of prophecy, son? A round ear there shall surely be. Born to be strong, raised to be free.
Fighting dragons in his youth, leading armies, nothing loth.
Ridding his country of a sore, joining two, then uniting four.
Until from seven there be one, only then will his task be done.
Honored by many, cursed by few, all will know what round ear can do.
I've heard it all my life, but I'm not sure that it applies.
I'm not sure either, son. But you did slay dragons in your recent youth, and you did, to your great credit, rid Rud of the sore that was her queen.
You're really Helen's father?
You doubt my word?
I don't know you. How can I know whether your word is good?
Maybe I should go elsewhere.
No, no, Come inside.
Now Kelvin began to see certain trace similarities between St. Helens and Helne. Nothing tangible, just hints in the lines of the face and the manner of gesture.
I've come from the kingdom of Eretex. I've come to visit my daughter and my famous son-in-law. But I've come for a purpose.
You have?
I'm here to lend you my age and experience. Joining two might as well mean Eretex and Rudd. You agree?
It might.
Things are not right in Eretex. The dissatisfaction is great. Together we can do it, son.
You mean annex Eretex?
Annex is a good word. So is invade. You know about Blastmore, of course. Rotten excuse for a king. Good chess player, but otherwise rotten. In his way, he's as bad or worse than your former queen.
I heard reports. He has a witch to keep people in line?
Old Melba. Ghastly hag. She goes up to Conjurer's Rock, waves her fingers and shouts gibberish and everybody faints. People there are real cowed, afraid to do anything on their own. With help? Well, that's a different matter.
I've heard she controls the elements through magic. Wind, water, fire, and earth. That she can make the wind blow, the water rise, the fire burn, and the earth tremble.
Superstitious nonsense. Are you really my commander's boy? John was a skeptic.
I haven't made any plans to invade Eretex. I have something else to do that may take time. My father and half-brother are in another frame and in trouble. I have to try to help them before...
Yes, I reckon they'll come in handy. Is it true that the queen escaped?
I'm not sure. Tyen thinks she's alive. Or he did before he left. Helen couldn't find her astrally, so maybe she's dead.
Or at least out of action, as far as this frame's concerned.
I suppose.
Well, we'll just have to go together. You'll need my help, and later we'll make plans together for Eretex.
Go? You mean with me? Into that other frame? That other existence? Only round ears can enter the chamber and make the trip.
I know. I've got the tickets on either side of my thick Irish head. Don't worry. You and I will do just fine.
As the serpent twisted around in the direction of the disturbance, a rope with a large loop at its end sailed meekly over the wide, flat head. A gigantic black war horse with a large, dark-featured man in the saddle made an abrupt turn in front of Tyen. The noose tightened, yanking the head to the side. The man in black brought down a sword on the serpent's snout. Tyen felt the spell relax as the serpent's eyes pulled away from him. The flank of the horse swept on by, and the great head struck the grass just in front of Tyen. Now the rider was circling a tree, the rope still attached to the serpent. The slack went out of the rope, and the horse backed as the rider jumped down and ran on foot, charging the serpent with a long spear. Tyen's right gauntlet dropped the sword, pulled his arm to the left gauntlet on the ground, and replaced it on his hand. The poison was still in it, and the pain resumed in his left fingers. Now the spear was flying through the air right toward one of the serpent's eyes. It struck near the lid of the eye and bounced off. It alighted almost at Kyan's running feet. The gauntlets acted. They had the spear by its shaft, and his sword stuck in the ground before Kyan had quite stopped. A forked tongue darted from the great serpent's mouth. Then the head snapped upright. The rope that held it snapped like a thread. Galvanized by the gloves, Kyan's arm moved. The spear flew upward. This time it struck true, right in the center of the serpent's dark eye. The razor-sharp point and the balanced heft of the weapon had effect. The specially forged spearhead plunged deeply in. The gauntlets hauled Tyen forward. With no wasted motion, they reached for the moving silver wall. Then, to his complete surprise, they propelled him into a handspring that landed him on the monster itself. Tyen found himself running along a slowly moving and abruptly, sharply jerking surface. Now he was on a huge tossing head. The left glove, overriding the pain of his hand, grabbed the edge of the eye. The right glove captured the shaft of the spear. The left gauntlet shifted its grip as Kyan's body slid entirely off the snake's head. He found himself pulling on the spear with both hands hanging in midair, but the spearhead was barbed. It would not come out without inflicting far worse damage than it had on entry. Scarlet blood spurted some of it onto him, but he could not let go. Acid drops flew from the bared fangs. One drop of it struck Kyan's face on the left cheekbone. Relentlessly, the gauntlets forced the spear inward, rocking it, questing for the serpent's brain. The head snapped about with such violence that even the blood-soaked gauntlets could no longer hold. A loop of rope landed on him and tightened. Kyan was hauled in a new direction, helplessly. In a moment, he found himself up against the horse. The stranger was there, slapping something cold against his face. The pain abated. Kyan raised his left arm with its gauntlet, and the stranger put the medicine on its burn. Instantly, the brown spot disappeared, and so did the burning in Kyan's hand.
You are one brave warrior. First you scored on the eye after I missed. Then you ran right up the thing's neck and drove it in for the finale. I never saw nerve like that. But you got disoriented by the venom, so I lassoed you out. I knew you couldn't see well anymore. The stuff gets in your eye and your brain so that even when you win, you lose. That's a bad burn. But we got the salve on in time. You should be fine now.
The gauntlets did it. I only followed where they led.
Gauntlets? They're magic, aren't they? No wonder. Must have come from Muvar.
Muvar? You've heard of him?
Hasn't everybody? Where have you been? Not that it matters. The name's Jack. Smoothie Jack, they call me. Best skin thief in the Seven Kingdoms. And you?
I'm a stranger.
Native to Hud, or from one of the other six?
No.
Rudd at home, Hud here. Still, Seven Kingdoms.
You know the girl?
Kyan started to shake his head. The pain was not nearly as bad now, and the burning had become more of a freezing sensation. Then he realized that he did know her, or almost did. Back home, that face, that beautiful face, and the curvaceous form with the definitely jutting breasts had belonged to a girl his mother had wanted him to marry, Lenora Barley.
You look as though you do.
Someone. Almost the same.
Damn flop ears. Sacrificing a slave girl any rich man would pay a fortune for.
You deal in slaves?
No! I was one. I deal only in releasing them. King Roforth, cursed be his imperial name, is the reason there's still slavery. His wife, good woman that she be, would like to end it. But I suspect you know that as well as I.
No, I didn't. I'm really a complete stranger.
We wouldn't dare try to take the skin before sundown, and by that time the flop ears will be here. Besides, no warhorse fold could ever carry a skin weighing as much as that one. That's a shame. Be a real fortune. Release a lot of slaves with what that'd bring.
The girl. We'd better release her.
If we do, the flop ears will try to follow us.
After facing that, I'm not much scared. Who are the flop ears?
Kyan retrieved his sword and ran back to the girl. Up close, she looked even more like Lenore Barley. With one easy swing of the sword, the gauntlets cleaved through the chain.
Oh, thank you! Thank you!
I'm a stranger. From out of this world, you might say. You?
Lonnie Burke, originally from Fairview. I'm afraid the tax collector took me directly to the flop ears they want to sacrifice each year, and they want her to be a stranger, comely, blonde, and virginal.
Then you've never actually been a slave?
Slave boys were routinely beaten to break their spirits. Slave girls were routinely raped until they stopped resisting.
I told you I was never taken to the mart. To please the flop ears and collect the most silver, the agent kept me safe. Even so, he made me an offer to take me out of the line if I agreed to, you know, and not let on. But I knew he was married and he was so ugly and smelled so bad, I knew I'd prefer the serpent.
Perhaps you made a fortunate choice. You mentioned flop ears. Were those the short people I saw here before?
You don't know about the flop ears?
As I said, I...
They can freeze a mortal person in his tracks just by looking at him. That's why we can't resist them.
A mortal person? But all of us are mortal.
Yes.
Jack appeared, leading his horse.
I'm heading back to the Barrens before the flop ears come back. You two want to come?
If we can ride.
Oh, don't worry about Bets. She can carry all of us. Only no skin, blast it. I'm afraid not even that chain. Enough weight is enough for her.
These barrens.
Blank, worthless land inhabited solely by outlaws and other dangerous creatures. Surely you've heard of it.
Yes.
Back home, it was the Sadlands. Here it would, of course, be almost the same.
Well, climb on. You, Missy, ride in front of me. You, what was your name?
Kayan. Kayan Knight.
That's right, Kayan. Huh. You ride behind me and hang on to me or the side of the saddle.
It wasn't quite the arrangement Kayan had envisioned, but he took Jack's hand and allowed himself to be pulled up on the back of the great horse. Kayan cocked his head to a now familiar sound.
Jack, if you want skin, silver, why don't you take the chimes?
You daft?
No, I'm a stranger. If you want silver, why not—
Because the Flop-Ears treat the chimes with their curse. You don't take a chime, or even part of one. If you do, you'll die before night.
Really?
Really.
Jack, if you don't mind my asking, why the chimes?
You certainly don't know much of this world, do you?
No. Not this world, at least.
It's to mark boundaries, at least that's what's always said. Something to do with where the serpents are and where there are ancient secrets much better kept by Flop-Ears. No one in his right mind goes near a chime. You must be from another world.
I am.
Well, that doesn't surprise me. Anyone who would come wandering into Serpent Valley on foot has to be from a really distant place.
They rode on for a while before coming to a stop in a small grove in order to let the horse rest.
Couldn't help but notice that strange-looking weapon you have in your scabbard. Do you mind if I saw it?
Kayan drew the weapon and handed it to him butt first. Jack took it, reversed it, and looked into the bell.
No bow?
It's not a crossbow.
So I see. Something to move ours, I bet.
It is.
Well, hold on to it. Could be valuable. You ready to ride? Really ride?
Kelvin wasn't at all happy about having to leave Helen and John and his friends the Crumbs, but he was even less happy about St. Helens's offer to accompany him. He thought around it all day long while they visited and caught up on family matters that neither had learned before. There was just no way out of it. Every time he attempted to say that it was his responsibility and his alone, St. Helens was certain to turn it about.
Yes, yes, I agree, Hackleberry. Very important that we get your father here if he lives. He can train the troops and make the plans better than me. Not that you're not round-eared, of course, but then remember, so are St. Helens and your old man.
I really don't know about Aretex yet. I feel Rudd shouldn't interfere unless we're urged by Aretex's people. Beside King Rufford.
Rufford, that old fraud.
He's a good man, a good king.
Good for nothing if you ask me. Who let the bitch queen take over? Who sat around while your father, no offense, lad, bedded her and made a son?
By then the king was in the dungeon and—
And your old man was weak. He wasn't like that in the old days. Or maybe her old man, Zatanas, cast a few spells. A little tampering with the wine and any man.
It could have been. Zatanas was a powerful magician.
Destroyed by a boy. No offense, lad, but that's what you were. So now, a few months later, you're a man, or think you are. Doesn't matter. The point is, you're right. That old man of yours was my commander, and from what I hear, he's come to his senses. We need him for Aretex and for what comes after.
I really don't know yet.
Of course you don't. How could you? Round ear of prophecy or not, you're still the boy.
Mr. Riley.
St. Helens, lass. It's St. Helens or father.
I'd rather not call you father. To me, my father is—
Flambeau. Yes, yes, good man. I know how you feel. I don't insist on it, though it is my due. St. Helens will do just fine.
St. Helens? What do you mean by coming here and insulting my husband and his father? We didn't even know you were alive before you knocked on our door. Why should you—
Hey, hey! Chip off the old block, huh, Hackleberry? My own daughter, sure. Well, I didn't insult him. I'm not insulting the best commander I ever had in the Nor-American army and his son. No, ma'am, not me, not the old saint. He didn't call me Truthful Riley for nothing before I tired of it. When I spout off, I spout the truth. Always have and am always gonna.
St. Helens, I really think that's enough.
Yes, it is, lass. Deed it is. Hackleberry, don't you think those red spots on her cheeks are cute? Her mother used to get those. Once when I came home late with a load, potent stuff, that local brew, she got them real fierce. Gave me the tongue-lashing of my life, and I stood there and took it because I had it coming. She made me sleep in the barn that night. And me, a big, randy buck in those days who lived mostly for love-making and fights.
Mr. St. Helens? We're grateful for your visit, but my wife and I aren't used to visitors. We've just gotten back from visiting my mother and her parents. Her mother and foster father... I mean the Flambeaus. We've just gotten this house built and the furniture moved in, and then Helm checks up on my missing brother?
Yes, you told me. Nothing to do but go there and rescue them, I agree. Fools shouldn't have gotten themselves in a mess, but things happen. Me? I want to see that other frame so bad it's tormenting me, but from what I'm told, it will probably be almost the same as here. I'm not sure of that myself. Just could be that other frame is Earth, where your father and I come from.
It can't be Earth. Helen and I saw.
Yes, the vision bit. Guys in my army outfit used to inhale an herbal smoke and claim they had visions where they could see all over the Earth. Maybe they did, but me, I doubted it.
That's very interesting, St. Helens, but with dragonberries, you don't just see visions. You move away from your body at the speed of thought. You go anywhere you want to, and...
Yes, yes, and I'm ready to take your word for it. My old commander's son doesn't lie.
No, sir, he doesn't.
So, when do we go? We've been wasting time talking here when all the time you say the commander's in trouble. In a jailhouse, no less.
Dungeon. Apparently the dungeon of the local king.
Then we'd better get moving, hadn't we? You ready to go now? I'm ready if you're ready.
Now? But you've been traveling by foot and the day's far gone. I thought...
An early morning start. Most sensible. The commander would approve. Can't fight if you're exhausted. That reminds me. Helm, you got any more of that appleberry pie? And how about some of the local grog before we sleep? A little wine?
I'll get the wine, Father.
Fine, fine, lad. Nothing too expensive, though. From what I hear, the king settled on you. You can afford it. Take no heed, son. I know the pride you'll take in serving your daddy-in-law the best.
Kelvin left the house for the local wine shop, hoping his formidable irritation wasn't showing. He reached the shop and made his selection by the nearness of the bottle. He was counting out the rudnas from his coin bag when he looked up and saw a large man with a point of one ear missing. More Crumb, Lester's father and John's father-in-law.
Kelvin, you rogue! You and the little girl celebrating a Hackleberry-to-be already?
Not yet, I'm afraid. Maybe just as well. Things keep coming up, besides those you know about. We have problems.
Your marriage?
No, nothing like that.
In a moment, Kelvin was telling more about Helen's visiting relative.
And you're really going into the floor with him?
Not if I can help it. But he's a little hard to discourage.
Tell you what, Kelvin. Lester and I will just sort of casually drop by in the morning. It's a long way to the old palace and that river chamber. Least we can do is tag along. If you want your St. Helens to stay, we'll see that he does. Call it payment for the times you've saved my life and my boy's life.
If he doesn't talk you into thinking it's a good idea.
That windbag you described couldn't talk more and Lester Crumb into a free fight.
Kelvin didn't answer. That windbag seemed to be having no trouble talking Kelvin himself into anything. Helen busied herself in the kitchen while St. Helens ate the pie. As she scrubbed away at a pan that had held the pie and didn't really need that much scrubbing, she tried hard to control the temper she knew she had inherited.
That man, my father. I can't stand him. I can't stand him.
In the Hackleberry dining room, St. Helens was savoring the last bites of the pie. Appleberries baked in a pie had the tartness and texture of raspberries combined with the flavor and aroma of a Jonathan apple. The little girl was angry with him. He could see why. He'd have to work on that, hide the old basic nature and bring out the winning charm. After all, it would be only for a short time, and then he'd be no more charming than he felt like being. Once he had control, he'd be in charge and they would know it as well as he.
Helm! Does Kelvin still have the laser the commander gave him? You know, the earth weapon he used in the war?
He has it, St. Helens. His father said to get rid of it, but he held on to it. As long as he has it, he doesn't have to worry about any danger he might face. Father, I said.
He's taking it with him into the other frame?
Of course.
And the gauntlets, he's taking them also?
Certainly.
That's fine. Just fine.
St. Helens smiled, thinking how very fine it would be, even if the boy didn't come around for him. Not that he wouldn't. He was a smart enough boy. But if need be, St. Helens could take the laser and the gauntlets, and then let old Melba try to stop him. Just let her try. And he'd fry her and prove to the Aratexians just how vincible the invincible crown actually was. If need be, he knew he could do it all, entirely by himself, if he had the weapons. John finished polishing the last of her throw stones and dropping it into her ammunition pouch by her sling. She turned from the table as Lester strode in, and seeing he was alone, she voiced her thought.
Les, I think we should talk him out of it.
What? Talk Kelvin out of going for his father and his brother?
There's also the Queen. We can't be certain she's not there alive in that other frame. Would you want her back in Rudd?
Well, no, but that's ridiculous. The war's over. She ruled only with the help of Zatanna's sorcery. Even if she were to come back here alive, she'd be powerless.
She's Zatanna's daughter. That could mean something.
Very little. And now that Kelvin's fulfilled the line of prophecy...
John knew that Kelvin wasn't brave. He was just Kelvin. Without her and her sling and Lester and his father and the gauntlets and laser, without those, he would be just another man.
You're right, dear. He's slain dragons and he's won Rod citizens their freedom. And he saved my life and yours. He's a hero born and there's never been his equal in all history. Kelvin, my brother, is the round ear of prophecy.
The outlaws' camp was nothing more than a small collection of tents, several of them ragged and flapping with great holes. The land was as barren as most deserts, but a few prickly plants of assorted sizes grew, and a fence of sorts had been made around the camp by dragging in some of the larger specimens and forming them into a line. A man with a broad chest came forth to meet them. He was a startling sight. He was the very image of the opposition leader in Rudd who had supported Kelvin. Morton Crumb, except for his whole round ears.
This is Matthew Biscuit. Matt, this is Cayenne Knight from a far and distant land.
Jack dropped off the horse and assisted Lonnie down. Cayenne dropped down by himself.
And this one's Lonnie Burke from Fairview. She was going to be the sacrifice. Now between us, Cayenne and I slew a really big serpent. You should have seen him fight.
Silver?
What else? But of course silver, but far too big. We'd need a dozen good horses just to drag it here. Besides, you know the flop ears will be out.
No doubt. What's he doing here?
What are you doing here, lad?
My father and mother came to this frame from a world almost like it. We haven't any silver serpents, but we have golden dragons there.
Dragons? Well, them legendary beasts. Storybook stuff.
So are serpents big enough to swallow war horses? Back home, I mean. In the frame I come from.
Frame? What are you talking about?
If you don't know, you may think I'm making this up. There are worlds made up of tiny specks my father calls atoms, and much space between these atoms, just as there is between stars. Most everything is space, considered this way. So worlds and universes lie side by side, interpenetrating, sometimes overlapping, touching slightly here and there. Each universe, each world connecting and adjoining universes, only a little different from each other. Our world's people have pointed ears, while another world's people have round ears. One world has silver serpents, while another has golden dragons.
Bosh! Superstitious junk. The rulers want us to believe that nonsense so they can keep us repressed.
But it's so. I know it is, because my father originated on a world where they have horseless carriages, and moving pictures, and talking boxes, and all sorts of strange things. Then, there's an alien Muvar who left a chamber from which round ears could travel to other worlds. Muvar the Magnificent, we called him. He lived a long, long before my time, and he left my home frame after a battle with the local sorcerer. The sorcerer was later destroyed by my brother.
By your brother?
Yes. The round ear Muvar predicted would. Well, he predicted a lot for him in my home frame. He slew dragons in his youth, as the prophecy says, and he rid his country Rudd of its sore, a tyrannous government.
Sounds as if you had very much the same setup as here. We too have a tyranny. Our leader, King Rofirth, has to be overthrown someday. You don't suppose you could give us some tips?
I'm afraid not. I was not really part of it. My brother could help, or my father, if we can find him.
You think he's here? In our world?
I hope so. I read the instructions carefully, and I know the setting on the machine that hasn't changed for centuries. I feel this is where my parents went. Certainly this must be where Muvar went. You have legends about him?
We have Muvar. Or at least, we had him. Strange old man, it said. He performed some miracles and then sort of vanished. Some say he's still around, but no one knows.
Of course, there's our local magician, who claims him as an ally. He's prattled about him for years. He's shut up about him lately, though, ever since Rofirth took his daughter to wed. If you ask me, all his talk was just a scheme to make that happen. The one opposition leader in the land, and his daughter just happens to have beauty that kings would trade their thrones for. He makes out fine now, old Zotanus does, but he's not conjuring much. Word is that he's a permanent guest at the palace and King Rofirth's main helper.
Well, I certainly don't believe in your almost identical worlds.
As comely as he had first thought Lani, Kyan also found her a bit annoying at times.
I heard those stories when I was a child, but until now nothing has shown up to confirm them.
Muvar. Muvar showed up.
Maybe he did. And maybe he's just a story.
Glancing around the camp, frustrated, he was surprised at the faces he almost recognized, men whose aspects he had seen around the palace during his youth. A very small man running on the short legs of a dwarf came from a nearby tent and up to them. Quickly, this person took the reins of the warhorse and led it to a spot near the fence where he tethered it to a ring set in a large rock. He clambered up on the rock and moved the horse around while he wiped it down with a rag. Then, rushing to the tent, his legs blurring with the speed.
Happy return, master!
A moment later, he returned, carrying a sack of grain for the horse on his bent but adequate back.
Quito!
What's that?
Quito, the dwarf.
Hito, here. You knew him well?
Not very.
Well, that one's a saint. Kindest person I ever saw. Hardest working person I ever knew. Cheerfulest, best-natured person ever. Was he in your world as well?
Not exactly a saint.
Huh. How do you plan on finding him?
What? Oh, my parents. I have a plan. Unless, of course, you can help me.
What's your plan?
Kyan told him about the dragon berries and showed them.
You have anything like these in Hud?
Never heard of them. But they sound like something that might eliminate the need for a lot of spy work.
They did.
When are you gonna take one?
I thought maybe when I had somebody to watch me. My heart will stop beating. My breathing will stop. I'll look as if I'm dead.
Well, I'll watch. Come along to my tent.
Kyan followed him. In a few moments, he was stretched out on a bearer hide on the floor of the tent, holding one of the small dark berries up to the lamplight. Nothing much to do now but to go through with it, though he dreaded the prospect. Not giving himself a chance to think, he popped the berry into his mouth. There was nothing for a moment. Wasn't it working? Then he noticed that the top of the tent was nearer than it had been. Had a supporting pole broken? He turned his head and looked down. There was his body below, lying deathly still. He thought of moving outside, and abruptly he floated through the tent wall without making contact and emerged at the front. How did Helm do this?
Oh, yes! Concentrate on a person. On a face.
A face came to mind. A woman's oblong visage of clear complexion, framed by hair as red as the sheen of a dragon, with eyes the color of green feline magic. Instantly, he was transported, moving past hills and villages as if flying to a palace high on a river bluff. The palace was almost like the one in which he had grown up, though the Rudd structure had been on low ground, with an underground river almost beneath it. Then he was inside, moving from room to room so blurringly swiftly that he was unable to note their details. He stopped. There was the face. His mother's beautiful face. She was seated on a divan. Beside her, holding her hand, was a tall, straight, elderly man with dark gray hair. His grandfather. Both were gone from his home frame, one departed, the other dead, yet here they were, alive and unhurt. His mother and his grandfather, oblivious of his presence. He was shaken, despite having no body to shake.
Please, please, my child, remember who you are. You are Zoltana's daughter and the queen.
But he... How can you permit him, Father? How?
I told you, my magic is only for little good things. I can help keep him controlled, but I'm powerless to destroy him.
Oh, Father, Father, if only you could stop him.
Hush, dearest. You are speaking of your husband, the king.
But he's so evil.
I know, and he's getting more so all the time. Bringing flop ears here was bad enough, but offering to share his rule with them if they would help him conquer is worse. I have nothing, I fear, to combat it.
Hearing the words, Kayan was finally able to realize that the woman and man were not his mother and grandfather. Both had round ears, while his relatives had ears as pointed as anyone in Rudd. How long would the berry last? He had wanted to find his mother, but he had zeroed in only on her face. Did that mean that she wasn't in this frame? Or did it mean that the berries worked only on natives? He could not decide, and he knew there was little time. His father, think of his father. He visualized John Knight's face as well as he could. The walls of the palace disappeared, and he was above hills and rivers and farmlands, moving with that unreal velocity of thought. Then... he was back in the valley where he had killed the serpent. He moved along the ground, everything blurring, and then through a rock wall and into an area where flop ears abounded. Their ears. But he was already past them, along and through a rock doorway in a cliffside. He halted. There, on a bed, pale and unshaven, lay John Knight.
Father! Father, you're alive!
The man's eyes flicked back and forth, but he did not open his mouth.
Who's that? Who spoke?
Astonished, Kayan saw the other person in the room, a young flop-ear female. Yes, those ears really were flopped over. What a sight.
You leave, bad spirit! You leave!
She had hurt him. He had no body. He was present only in spirit form. He could make no physical sound, yet there was no doubt that this odd woman had heard.
Go away! Leave here! Leave before I get help! Herzik can capture you, you know. He can imprison you, put you in a tree or serpent. You want that spirit?
No! No!
Then go! Instantly!
He went. But he made himself pause to look at the huge cauldron where the flop ears were melting down silver. Even as he looked, one came bringing an armload of what seemed like feather-light serpent skin. The flop ear mounted the wooden steps of the scaffold and dumped the armload into the silver soup. There was a puff of steam. Another flop ear stirred the broth with a huge ladle.
Boo!
The flop ear almost dropped the ladle. He teetered for a moment at the edge of the soup, in danger of falling in. Kayan willed himself back, away from the connected valleys, back to where he had started.
Gosh, I thought you were dead for certain.
Not dead, just near.
As rapidly as Kayan could, he told the bandit leader what had happened.
And you're certain he said Rofirth is making a pact with the flop ears?
I told you what I heard.
God, that's true, there isn't much time. So Tanis could be mistaken, and I hope he is. But if he makes a pact, Lord, old Rofirth will end up bossing all the Seven Kingdoms with him.
If we can rescue my father, perhaps he can help. I'm not sure how. Or maybe he can go back to Earth and get Earth weapons, lasers, flying devices. They might help.
I'm not sure what you're talking about. But if you think your father can help us defeat Rofirth, then we'll rescue him. Only that won't be easy. The Serpent people aren't like ordinary mortals. They have magic. The ability to stop a fighting man in his tracks with just a glance. It's only one of their talents.
But there has to be a way.
I'll grant you that. And with your ability to spy, just maybe we'll find it. To start with, we can't actually face flop ears. If we try it, they stare at us and we're helpless sticks. And that means we'll have to steal your father from them some other way, and that won't be easy. Now, from what you say, they can even detect you in the astral state.
Yes, but only when I spoke, I think. When I was silent, they didn't know I was there.
But you didn't keep your mouth shut? Thanks to that, they may now know what to watch for.
King Philip Blastmore of Aratex moved the Black Queen across the board.
Check.
Melba, pudgy and squat, and so wrinkled of face that it resembled a badly cured animal pelt, looked up.
Well, you concede.
Oh, King, do you wish to win this game, or do you prefer for Melba to demonstrate her strategy?
Demonstrate your strategy.
Then this is what I will do.
Leaning over the board, eyes still focused on him, she puffed up her cheeks so that the wrinkles faded to mere patinas. When he finished blinking his eyes, he saw his Black Queen on the carpet.
I'm afraid that's not permitted, Melba. You can't touch a piece except to move it in the designated way.
You say this is an ancient game of war. In war, all things are fair.
Well, yes, but...
I did not touch your queen. I only sent air to remove her from the battle.
It's still not permitted.
Then perhaps another strategy.
Melba pointed a finger so knobby it almost resembled a dead twig from an appleberry tree, and the Black Queen burst into flame.
Oh, really, Melba? You should not have done that. Now that the round ear has left, who will duplicate it for me?
No problem.
Melba snapped her fingers, and the piece on the floor became uncharred painted wood.
This time, illusion. In battle to save your kingdom, real.
That certainly does make an impression.
Or if the markers you call men were really men and threatened the kingdom...
She picked up a vase filled with flowers and tossed the flowers on the carpet next to the queen. Just as he was wondering what she was up to, she sloshed the water from a vase on his side of the board. As he hastily left his chair, the water spilled across and dripped on the floor, carrying with it a wash of black pawns.
I agree. That would win a battle. But this is a game.
Yes. Game finished now.
Yes, finished. You did well. So well that we will not have to play again.
Good. Game piece is not needed here. Melba can direct forces without.
I'm sure you can, and have.
Melba stood up.
I go now to my quarters. Your general is coming.
He is? How do you know that?
Blastmore watched her swirl of dark skirts as she seemed to drift rather than walk across the floor. By the time he had blinked and re-blinked, she was gone, apparently vanished from the room and possibly the palace. He sat there for a moment, rearranging the chess pieces as if for a game. He wished that he had not had that falling out with St. Helens. He had really enjoyed the Round Ear's companionship, especially his wonderful stories about an unlikely world called Earth. He thought again about the way the big man had shown up asking for something called sanctuary, and the way he had paid for it by making himself a friend. In all his life, St. Helens, the Round Ear, had been his only friend. True, when he was a child he had playmates, but when he became angry with them, as he concluded in retrospect he too frequently did, Melba arranged for things to happen to them. By the time he cooled off, it was too late. They were gone. Then there were his parents and his sisters and brothers and all his relatives. Things happened to them, one by one, and not by his design. So there had been servants and courtiers and soldiers in diminishing number, and Melba, mainly Melba. She was bad company. She was always there when he needed someone. As with the attempted chess game just now, he wanted someone with whom to play, and she played, in her fashion. At least, it hadn't been boring. But in the past, when he had somehow been unhappiest, despite his improving material position, St. Helens had shown up. The big, gruff man had seemed to like the young prince for himself, and they had gotten along fine. Sometimes, when misunderstanding threatened, Melba had assisted. Nothing had happened to the Round Ear. Blastmore had suspected that she was responsible for the Round Ear's existence. Then he had decided that St. Helens was too complex to be her creation, but that she tolerated the friendship for her own reasons. He did not question this because he valued the man's company too much. St. Helens might be big and rough and crude, but he was real. No need to worry about him being involved in any conspiracy. St. Helens always said exactly what he thought, and his remarks about the, as he put it, ass-kissing courtiers were delightfully on target. If Blastmore wanted a candid opinion, St. Helens would give it, not worrying or even caring much about possible offense, even about Melba herself, though there the man had had the caution to lower his voice before calling her a bag of excrement. The actual term had been unfamiliar, but the context had clarified it. Now, St. Helens was gone, and depression had returned. Blastmore's one hope was that soon he would be of an age to marry. He was viewing some of the young ladies of the court with increasing interest. Melba never let him get really close to any of them alone, but once he got to marry one, it could get really interesting. At least he would have good company again. The chessboard whirled before him as he sat staring at it, waiting for the general Melba had promised. Sometimes he got these dizzy spells when he thought of St. Helens and how much the big man had meant to him. They had gotten along so well. If he had asked the man about women, he was sure to have had a crude but pertinent answer, exactly the kind he craved. St. Helens had given so much and asked for so little, just food and sleep and safety.
I know what it is to be lonely, lad. I know.
But then the round ear had started paying attention to what Blastmore did and what Melba did and to all who came and went about the palace. He began asking questions. Suddenly, unexpectedly, St. Helens had become angry with him.
It's not right, the condition of your people, lad. It's all that old bag's influence. You gotta stand up to her. You gotta rule on your own.
But how, St. Helens, how?
I'll tell you how, lad. First of all, you've got to realize that she's just a person. She might know some good conjurer's tricks, but let me tell you, I've seen some pretty clever performances back on Earth. She's got the people scared of her, and for good reason. You've got to undo some of that. Let people bring you gifts because you're their monarch and they love you. Don't force them to bring tribute or face ruin at the hands of your witch. A good king can rule wisely and well and have everything. A wise king doesn't have to worry about enemies. Tell your tax collectors to ease up on people. Sometimes a man can't pay, and sometimes he doesn't want to pay. If he really can't pay, you have to try treating him so that he can.
Blastmore shook his head. It hadn't surprised him that when he did nothing about the tax collectors or Melba, his friends had disappeared. He remembered seemingly unconnected episodes of the past when there had been murmurings among relatives about policy and taxes, and then those relatives had suffered misfortune. Getting a glimmering of the way of it, he had been smarter with St. Helens. He had had the man followed and watched. He had forbidden Melba to harm him.
Let him alone and things will be as before. He can't harm us. He doesn't have your power.
That is true. But still, round ears do bear watching.
I'm having him watched. If he tries to do harm, I will learn of it, and then I will give you instructions.
You will give me instructions? Very well. When he causes trouble, you give me instructions.
Blastmore knew he was young, but he was not as young as he once had been, and he had taken the trouble to learn as much of the way of things as he could. He knew that he was the last of the royal line. If anything happened to him, there would be no help for it but revolution, because the people were incapable of selecting a new monarchy without violence. Melba would be their first target, so it was in her interest to keep him safe. After all, he hadn't countermanded her tax policy. He knew the value of wealth and the advantage of keeping the peasants poor. He wished St. Helens hadn't chosen that particular case to argue. The man had assumed that Blastmore was ignorant of the ways of the tax collectors, and it would have been awkward to disabuse him. But now it was time to begin asserting himself with Melba, knowing that they were in agreement anyway. He needed to prepare for the time when they might not be in agreement. Now, raising his eyes from the chessboard, he found General Ashcroft standing in front of him. A tall man with heavy eyebrows, He had always appeared as if conjured by Melba's magic.
Your Majesty, following your specific orders, I have kept track of the round ear known as St. Helens. As you know, he tried to stir up sedition and create rebellion in various parts of the realm. Each time, following orders, Melba has thrown the fear of magic into those he appointed leaders. A tornado, a fire, a groundquake, a flood, and rebellion dies before it's born. All who foolishly still oppose your policies have died, with the exception of St. Helens, who was allowed each time to escape.
That is well. And now?
Now, your Majesty, the Round Ear has left Aratak's borders.
What?
He has recrossed the river into Rudd. He has heard reports that his daughter is now married to the Round Ear there. It is believed by my agents that he has gone to this Round Ear of Prophecy to get his aid, and perhaps also help from the King of Rudd.
Against me? Against Melba?
Do you wish to send assassins?
I want him followed in Rudd. When this is practical, I want him captured, taken across the river into Aratex, arrested, and brought here in chains.
The general nodded, saluted, and departed.
This is going to fix everything.